10. Bones of Contention. I do not think it is an exaggeration to say history is largely a history of inflation, usually inflations engineered by governments for the gain of governments. Friedrich August von Hayek, Austrian economist, 1899-1992. Peter Martyr, 1457-1526, was an Italian cleric who never set foot in the New World. Nevertheless, De Orbe Novo, On the New World, which was published in 1530, was an epic depiction of the first 8 decades of Spanish rule in the West Indies. It became one of the most influential and popular works ever written on the subject. Without the benefit of first-hand knowledge, Martyr obtained the information for his book from interviews conducted with sailors, clergymen, and others returning from overseas. In Book 1, which detailed the voyages of Christopher Columbus, the author included a section on the notorious cannibal hut described by Dr. Chanca during Columbus's second voyage, and whose quote opened the previous chapter. Martyr, however, appears to have taken a bit of creative license with the physician's account, expanding the incident and giving it a truly horrific tone. Instead of the single hut described by Chanca, there were multiple dwellings, each outfitted with a kitchen, in which birds were boiling in their pots. Also, geese mixed with bits of human flesh, while other parts of human bodies were fixed on spits, ready for roasting. Upon searching another house, the Spaniards found arm and leg bones, which the cannibals carefully preserve for pointing their arrows, for they have no iron. All other bones, after the flesh is eaten, they throw aside. The Spaniards discovered the recently decapitated head of a young man still wet with blood. Clearly, Martyr was instrumental in dehumanizing the Caribs, describing them as savages who treated their fellow islanders in much the same way Europeans might treat sheep or cattle. Additionally, in keeping with his pro-Columbus stance, Martyr also used the threat of cannibals, now described as having nearly supernatural powers, as a thinly veiled justification for the overt military theme of Columbus's third voyage, an expedition that became, in effect, a New World troop surge. The inhabitants of these islands, which from now on we may consider ours, women and men have no other means of escaping capture by the cannibals than by flight. Although they use wooden arrows with sharpened points, they are aware that these arms are of little use against the fury and violence of their enemies, and they all admit that 10 cannibals could easily overcome 100 of their own men in a pitched battle. So was there any real cannibalism going on in the Caribbean when Columbus arrived? Oxford-trained anthropologist Neil Whitehead suggests that while many reports of the behavior are examples of imperial propaganda, there are several reasons to think that the Caribs and other Amerindian groups did practice forms of ritualized cannibalism. Whitehead's rationale is that, in addition to the self-serving allegations of man-eating from Columbus and his men, reports from other Spaniards placed Amerindian cannibalism into social contexts, as funerary rites or rituals related to the treatment of enemies slain during battle. For example, in the 17th century, Jacinto de Carvajal wrote, "The ordinary food of the Caribs is cassava, fish, or game. They eat human flesh when they are at war and do so as a sign of victory, not as food." According to anthropologists, ritualized cannibalism can be differentiated into 2 forms, exocannibalism and endocannibalism. Exocannibalism, from the Greek exo, from the outside, refers to the consumption of individuals from outside one's own community or social group, while endocannibalism, from the Greek endo, from the inside, is defined as the ritual consumption of deceased members of one's own family, community, or social group. With regard to exocannibalism, a number of historical accounts claim that the Caribs consumed their enemies, those killed in battle, taken prisoner, or captured during raids. The belief was that this form of ritual cannibalism was a way to transfer desired traits, like strength or courage, from the deceased enemy to themselves. In other times and places, exocannibalism has been used as a way to both terrorize an enemy and feed the hungry. In the 1960s, anthropologist Pierre Clastres lived with the Ajé of Paraguay and claimed that one of the four groups that he studied ate their enemies. Similar claims have been made about the Tupinamba of eastern Brazil, most famously by Hans Staden, a 16th-century German shipwrecked while serving as a seaman on a Portuguese ship. In his 1557 book, True Story and Description of a Country of Wild, Naked, Grim, Man-Eating People in the New World, America, Staden, who reportedly spent a year in captivity before escaping, described raids in which the Tupinamba killed and ate everyone they captured, except apparently him. In the Pacific Theater during World War II, Allied prisoners of war described numerous instances in which their Japanese captors tortured and then ate their prisoners. Presumably, with their supply routes interrupted by Allied submarines and bombing raids, the Japanese were on such short rations that they resorted to cannibalism. In post-war tribunals, survivors testified that their captors acted systematically, selecting one individual each day and hacking off limbs and flesh while they were alive and conscious. American soldiers also became even more insistent about removing the bodies of their fallen comrades from the battlefield after it was discovered that the Japanese sometimes sliced off pieces of the dead with bayonets, a gory ritual some Americans began to practice as well. The most famous wartime incident of starvation-related exocannibalism was the Chichijima incident, in which Lieutenant General Yoshio Tachibana ordered his starving men on the island of Chichijima to execute a group of downed American airmen who had been captured after carrying out a bombing raid. Medical orderlies were then instructed to cut the livers from the bodies, and the organs were cooked and served to the senior staff. Tachibana and several others were arrested after the war, but since cannibalism was not listed as a war crime, they were actually convicted and hanged for preventing the honorable burial of the prisoners the officer and his men had eaten. Later, it was revealed that an American submarine had recovered one of the 9 downed flyers, thus saving him from a similar fate at the hands of the starving Japanese. The lucky man's name was Lieutenant George H.W. Bush. There is no such element of terror involved in the practice of endocannibalism, although it can overlap with some aspects of exocannibalism, in that body parts, in this case from relatives or group members, are consumed for reasons that include transferring the spirits of the dead or their traits into the bodies of the living. Anthropologists have proposed that, much like Christian burial rituals or the administration of last rites, endocannibalism was undertaken by some groups in order to facilitate the separation of the deceased's soul from its body. The Melanesians, those societal groups living in Fiji, the Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, and Papua New Guinea, reportedly practiced a form of mortuary cannibalism for this reason, consuming small tidbits from the bodies of their deceased relatives. This form of ritual cannibalism will be examined in detail in an upcoming chapter. Anthropologist Beth Conklin studied the Wari from the western Amazonian rainforest of Brazil. She reported that until the 1960s, the Wari consumed portions of human flesh as well as bone meal mixed with honey. Having conducted extensive interviews with Wari elders, she said that the Wari are keenly aware that prolonged grieving makes it hard for mourners to get on with their lives. With the corpse being the single most powerful reminder of the deceased, the Wari believed that consuming the body eradicates it once and for all. Beliefs are not, though. They were forced by missionaries and government officials to abandon their funerary rites and to bury their dead in what these strangers believed to be the civilized manner. Conklin said that this was a ritual the Wari found to be particularly repellent, since they considered the ground cold, wet, and polluting, and that to leave a loved one's body to rot in the dirt was disrespectful and degrading to the dead and heart-wrenching for those who mourned them. Getting back to the question of whether or not the Caribs were cannibals, several years ago, during a trip to Trinidad, I met Christo Adonis, the spiritual leader of the Trinidadian Amerindians. One of the first things I learned was that there were very few of his people left, with no full-blooded individuals among the roughly 600 surviving members. I quickly noted that Adonis avoids using the European-assigned names Carib and Arawak, which he considers slang terms. Instead, he refers to his ancestors as the Carina and Locono people. Mr. Adonis told me that his people did practice both endo-cannibalism, related to religious practices, and exo-cannibalism, as a way to gain power from their defeated enemies. His evidence for this claim derives solely from ethno-historical accounts passed down over hundreds of years. I told him that might make some folks skeptical. "Why," he asked me, "would indigenous historians pass on stories about their ancestors practicing cannibalism if the stories weren't based on actual customs?" Actually, I can think of some potential reasons for claiming one's ancestors were cannibals, such as to instill fear in their enemies, but anthropologist Neil Whitehead also thinks that the Caribs were man-eaters, although I found his rationale to be open to debate. To back up his claim, Whitehead offers accounts by non-Spanish writers describing the Amerindians they encountered as having carried out ritual cannibalism. Whitehead argues that since the English, French, and Dutch were enemies of the Spanish, they would have wanted to develop alliances with the Amerindians. Since the non-Spaniards were presumably on friendlier terms with the locals, they would have been in a better position to observe and report on the actual cannibalistic behavior of their native allies. Arguing against Carib cannibalism, perhaps, is the fact that the documentation by non-Spaniards regarding the behavior contains some seriously fanciful descriptions. For example, alongside his descriptions of anthropophagy, Sir Walter Raleigh wrote about some indigenous peoples having their heads located within their chests and their feet pointing backwards, the latter a characteristic that made them very difficult to track. Interesting for another reason entirely is the most famous piece of Columbus-related circumstantial evidence, Dr. Chanka's account of the recovery of 4 or 5 bones of human arms and legs in a hastily abandoned hut. In reality, the good doctor never saw the scene he wrote about in 1493 because he was not part of the landing party. This might come as a surprise, though, if you read Chanka's work, since his repeated use of the word "we" gives the impression that he had experienced the horrors of the cannibal hut firsthand. Though not a firsthand witness, Dr. Chanka was a strong supporter of Columbus, and because of his professional status, his written accounts carried tremendous weight. Historically, his letters make up much of what we know, or thought we knew, about the Admiral's second voyage to the New World. Another factor to consider is that Chanka's description of the cannibal hut was sent back to Spain, accompanied by a letter from Columbus, requesting that the doctor's salary be increased substantially. Since Columbus was already using the cannibal angle to justify his attempts to pacify and enslave the local residents, what are the odds that Dr. Chanka would have penned an accompanying document contradicting the Admiral's description of the Caribs as subhuman eaters of men? This conflict of interest raises serious doubts as to whether Chanka's account can be considered unbiased reporting. But even if the events described by Chanka did take place, the bones Columbus and his men collected from the infamous hut were more likely part of a funerary ritual rather than proof of cannibalism. According to historians and anthropologists, rather than burying their departed ancestors, some Amerindians preserved and worshipped their bones. In 1828, author and historian Washington Irving pointed out that during Columbus's first voyage, when human bones were discovered in a dwelling on Hispaniola, they were taken to be relics of the dead, reverently preserved. On Columbus's second visit, however, when bones were found in a hut presumably inhabited by Caribs, the finding became incontrovertible evidence of cannibalism. At best, then, Dr. Chanka's letter provides a brief, second-hand account of what may or may not have been the aftermath of cannibalism by the inhabitants of a single hut on the island of Guadeloupe. Meager evidence? Certainly, but the story gained far greater significance as additional authors wrote about the incident. In what would become a blueprint for cannibal tales throughout history, descriptions of the practice were penned decades or even centuries after the actual event and without the input of additional witnesses. It mattered little whether cannibalism took place in the New World or not, though, since most authors who wrote on the topic had already decided that it had. Historians and writers alike picked up on secondhand, unsubstantiated, and often fabricated stories, added a splash of red, then reported the tales as facts. In doing so, they may have enthralled their audiences with the bravery of European explorers, but they did a terrible disservice to history and to the indigenous people who became less and less human with each exaggerated account. As a result, readers, both casual and scholarly, were subjected to a 500-year-long indoctrination period during which they heard little, if anything, about the genocidal mistreatment of native populations or even the sociological significance of cannibalism if the practice did occur. Far more likely, they would come away believing that Columbus and the other European explorers had fought off hordes of cannibalistic subhumans, thus sparing many a grateful savage the horrors of the cooking pot. From the New World to Africa, Australia, and the Pacific Islands, cannibalism was generally perceived to be a widespread phenomenon, and it would be the role of good Christians, explorers, and the missionaries who invariably followed them, to take control of the situation and thus put an end to this most horrific of human behaviors. For the most part, this public mindset concerning ritual cannibalism remained until 1979. It was then that Stony Brook University anthropology professor William Ahrens initiated what became a loud and serious debate over the validity of cannibalism as a social practice. In his book, The Man-Eating Myth, Ahrens argued that, aside from some well-known instances of starvation-induced cannibalism, there was absolutely no proof that ritualized cannibalism had ever existed in any human culture. Instead, according to the anthropologist, the idea of cannibalism had become a handy symbol for unacceptable behavior practiced by others, a broad and malleable category of evildoers that included enemies, followers of non-Christian religions, and any groups determined to retain their uncivilized customs. The most certain thing to be said is that all cultures, subcultures, religions, sects, secret societies, and every possible human association have been labeled as anthropophagic by someone. Essentially, then, Ahrens asserted that colonial groups had been guilty of making false accusations of cannibalism against native populations across the globe and throughout history. With Christopher Columbus acting as a poster boy, applying the cannibal tag justified the condemnation and, if necessary, the eradication of anyone accused of engaging in this ultimate of taboos, a practice whose validity, Ahrens was quick to point out, was always unsupported by anything resembling first-hand evidence. The reaction to Ahrens's incendiary book was swift and mostly negative. His colleagues referred to his man-eating myth hypothesis as unsophisticated and dangerous, and that it does not advance our knowledge of cannibalism. Some critics also took the opportunity to attack Ahrens personally, with the most extreme assault coming from anthropologist Marshall Sollins, who claimed that Ahrens had proposed his outrageous theory for the sole purpose of generating controversy in an effort to sell books. Sollins took his accusations over the edge by comparing Ahrens to a Holocaust denier, a stance that even those who believed ritual cannibalism to be a commonplace occurrence found difficult to fathom. One anthropologist, who believed that cannibalism did occur, pointed out that Holocaust victims had been murdered because, like the Caribs, they had been labeled as others and, as such, they became perfect candidates for extermination. I found myself agreeing with much but certainly not all of Ahrens's hypothesis, in part because of the brutal pounding colonial invaders doled out to indigenous groups for centuries. On the other hand, my investigation into ritual cannibalism has led me to conclude that there is plenty of evidence to support the stance that some cultural groups practiced cannibalism and that they did so for a variety of reasons. As for the claims of Carib cannibalism, though, the fact remains that beyond the second and third-hand accounts, there isn't a shred of physical evidence, nor is there any indication that Columbus or his men ever witnessed man-eating firsthand. I met Dr. Ahrens on a bright sunny day in his office at Stony Brook University. He seemed apprehensive at first, but after telling him I had little interest in the sensational aspects of cannibalism and that I had an open mind regarding his own assertions on the topic, he began to open up. He explained that when anthropologists address the more recent claims of ritual cannibalism, much of the evidence they present comes from interviews they or their associates have had with tribal elders, none of whom practice cannibalism anymore. As Ahrens is only too happy to point out, these former cannibals all seem to have ceased their man-eating behavior just before the arrival of the anthropologists. I gathered that this was too much of a coincidence for him to accept. In response to this very point, Beth Conklin, who worked with the Wari in Brazil, argued previously that the reason anthropologists never observe cannibalism in person is because they are seldom the first outsiders to set foot in a newly contacted society. This role, she claimed, is filled by missionaries, government agents, frontiersmen or traders who see cannibalism as something to terminate immediately. Thus, according to Conklin and others, cannibalism either ceases altogether or goes underground before it can be studied firsthand. Conklin also raised her own concerns about the cannibal denial debate. Like the many priests, missionaries, colonial officers, and others who considered cannibalism antithetical to what it means to be human, scholars who insist that all accounts must be false seem to assume that cannibalism is, by definition, a terrible act. They appear blind to the possibility that people different from themselves might have other ways of being human, other understandings of the body, or other ways of coping with death that might make cannibalism seem like a good thing to do. In other words, just because we consider cannibalism an ultimate taboo, why should members of other cultural groups necessarily feel the same way? I asked Ahrens about Conklin's statement. "I think it's nonsense," he replied. "But couldn't there be a group of isolated people who grew up without the influences that lead Westerners to believe that cannibalism is a bad thing?" Ahrens threw me a dismissive wave. "I don't think that any group of people grow up isolated or innocent of what's going on around them, and I don't believe that one group does something that's not pretty pervasive among the species." He continued, "But if you see people eating each other, then you have to accept that they do it, and although I'd be disappointed to have to accept that, I would accept it." "Yeah, right," I thought, retaliating with a respectful but dismissive wave of my own. I found it hard to fathom that a man who had pretty much made a career of rejecting the concept of ritual cannibalism might be converted so quickly. "Honestly, I'd accept it," Ahrens assured me. "My problem is that no one ever sees it. Therefore, the pattern of observed behavior is not eating people, but assuming people eat people and never actually seeing it. The example of the Wari, that's a problem because no one has seen the Wari practicing cannibalism. So how about the bongo bongo? No one's ever seen the bongo bongo do it either. So you end up going around the world discussing something that no one's ever seen." Anthropologist Jerome Whitfield has been working on ritual cannibalism and its pathological consequences for several decades, principally in Papua New Guinea. I'd been corresponding with Whitfield and related to him my conversation with Ahrens. He responded via email. "Endocannibalism has been practiced and witnessed by thousands of indigenous people throughout the world. How come a white ethnocentric anthropologist, who has never spoken to these people or been in their country, can say what they do or why they do something?" Whitfield went on. "Interestingly, there have been public apologies in Fiji, Vanuatu, and Papua New Guinea by citizens of these countries for the killing and exocannibalism of missionaries. Are they making it up like the Wari?" To Whitfield, it sounded like Ahrens believes that there is A huge conspiracy with massive resources that wants to mislead the world into thinking that endocannibalism was an established practice. And as for a reliance on witnesses other than themselves, Whitfield wrote that, "All anthropologists rely on informants to explain what is happening, even if they witness the event themselves." So, did ritual cannibalism ever take place? Most anthropologists who've investigated the topic seem to think so. But is there any evidence beyond the ethnohistorical accounts? And if so, does it still take place today? As I would learn, to millions of people, the answer is apparently yes.